Welcome back to the Health Longevity Secrets Show with your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin. In honor of William Shakespeare's birthday on April 23rd, 1564, I am channeling the bard for this introduction. This is only the start of what we will soon be able to do with generative AI. And now, please enjoy this week's episode.
There are some people that just grab the bull by the horns and go for it. And they are fully in, totally committed, and they just do whatever it takes to get into ketosis, to optimize their diet, their sleep, their exercise. And it's really impressive. What I see is that there are other people who kind of prove that the concept works because they go in and out of it. And we had a gentleman recently who, you know, when he's in ketosis, he remembers his grandchildren's names. And when he's not, he doesn't.
Today, we get to unlock the secrets to maintaining a sharp mind as we age with the insights from Dr. Heather Sanderson. In this episode, Heather joins us to expose the potential for reversing cognitive decline, which was inspired by Dr. Dale Bredesen's complex system science approach to dementia. We get to witness the awe-inspiring story of Linda, whose battle with dementia was dramatically turned around, offering hope that brain health can be rejuvenated through comprehensive lifestyle changes. In this episode, we confront the unsettling reality of dementia's progression and the influence of genetic factors like the APOE4 allele. We challenge the myopic focus of mainstream research on beta amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's, advocating for a broader scope that incorporates managing inflammation, infections, nutrient deficiencies, and essential lifestyle factors such as diet and exercise. Concluding this powerful dialogue, we share the staggering success rates from studies where participants have shown measurable cognitive improvements using Dr. Bredesen's protocol. This episode isn't just about the promise of cognitive health. It's an invitation to us all to join a movement that's redefining what it means to age with strength and clarity of mind. This episode is brought to you by L Nutra, maker of the Prolong Fasting Mimicking Diet. If you'd like to try it, use the link in the show notes for 20% off. And now, please enjoy this week's episode.
Heather, it's such a pleasure to have you here at our summit.
Oh, welcome. Thank you so much for having me. You know, I saw the lineup and you have just a phenomenal superstar team here to share their insights and wisdom. And it's just a privilege to be considered among them.
Yes, well, we do. So let's start by telling us how you got into this area.
Yeah, sure. So this work very much found me. I definitely didn't go to medical school imagining that I would help people with dementia. In fact, I had been told over and over again by very smart, very well-meaning people that if somebody had cognitive decline or was going in the direction of Alzheimer's, there really was nothing that you could do. And then on the other side of my naturopathic training, you know, where we're very much thinking about things from a complex system science perspective, from a treat the cause perspective, treat the whole perspective, I met Dr. Dale Bredesen, or rather, I heard a lecture of his at a conference, and I was highly intrigued because he was describing bringing that complex system science approach to dementia and getting great results. And so, although I was skeptical, I went to his training and then was on the list of providers who had been trained by him. And so, sure enough, I had people show up in my clinic. And one of my first patients, her name is Linda. She came in with her husband and she had a MoCA score of 2. So the MoCA is the Montreal Cognitive Assessment that we use to quantify the degree of someone's cognitive decline. And hers was quite progressed. So her handwriting was affected. She could only answer me with one word sentences with just a yes or no to very simple questions. And although you could see that she had progressed quite severely with dementia and Alzheimer's, you could see the brightness of her personality. She had this great big smile and bright clothing and this black leather studded purse. And her husband was just so dedicated and much more confident in this Bredesen approach than I was at that stage. They took everything and ran with it. They dove in completely. They did not just dip their toes in the water with this approach. She got out of a moldy bedroom. They actually just moved from their bedroom that was moldy into their living room. And they started ballroom dancing 4 times a week. She got on the bioidentical hormone replacement. She got all of her dental work done. She got on all the supplements that I recommended, and they got into ketosis, and they did it together. And just 6 weeks later, her MoCA score was now a 7. So this MoCA score is on a scale of 30, and 30 is perfect. Normal is about 26 or above. And when you're at a 2, this is very severe disease. Now, when you're at a 7, it's still severe disease, but it meant that she was talking in sentences. It meant that she could bicker with her husband about something that had happened the night before. Her life had changed. Her experience of the world had changed in just 6 weeks. And so when I saw this happen for Linda, my first thought was, well, wait, what did we do wrong 6 weeks ago? Was it a bad day for her? And is this just a good day? But no, her husband said how dramatically she had already changed. And what I realized by the end of that visit was, if this was possible for Linda, what was possible for everyone else who was, you know, less far along the path of dementia? Somebody who maybe had genetic risk, but didn't even have any symptoms yet. Could they prevent this from ever happening? And at the very least, could we delay progression? And hopefully, could we reverse it for even more people? So you can imagine that from that moment, I have essentially committed my life to changing the narrative and getting this type of medicine out there and to make it practical and accessible to as many people as possible.
Well, it's so interesting that you started with somebody who was so deficient, as opposed to someone with a score, you know, in the low 20s, for example.
Right.
And that's great that even with someone like that, you were able to achieve some sense of improvement. So I can understand how with that as your first experiment, you would be very excited about the potential.
Yeah, and certainly my confidence goes up. Like Linda and her husband, the more fully you dive in, so the more completely and comprehensively you can apply the protocol, the more confidence I have. Of course, the younger someone is, the more confidence I have. And then not necessarily chronologically younger, right? The younger their cells are, the younger we are. And really that's a big part of this approach. This is a longevity centric summit. And it's about our cells being younger, not just our chronological age. And that's what makes everything kind of spin in this virtuous cycle rather than that downhill spiral. Yeah. And then the other thing that drives my confidence is, of course, how far along in the disease process. So when it's early on, but still measurable cognitive decline, it's much cheaper, easier, and simpler to get that reversal versus those later stages.
Yeah. So these cognitive declines, whether it's Alzheimer's or some other aspect of dementia, how does that fit into your particular notion about how and why we age and longevity?
Yeah, great question. So I think a lot of people assume that things go downhill as we age. And I would like to just reject that premise completely. So there's a great book by a woman named Becca Levy. She's a PhD scientist out of Yale, and she wrote a book called Breakthroughs on Aging. Oh gosh, of course, now I'm going to blank on the name. But it's essentially the premise of it. I'll remember it. The premise of the whole book is that our mindset as it relates to aging is extremely important, and that we can actually live 7 years longer if we have a positive association with aging. And she describes aging in Confucius cultures like Japan and China, and then also in the American deaf community, where aged people are revered. So the older you are, the more wisdom and experience you have to share, and that this is highly valued in those communities. And when you see that, you don't get the typical declines that we expect in a standard American culture of declines in measurable things like hormones, in cognition, in how much we exercise, and all of these things. When you expect that it's only going to get better, that's actually what happens. Mm-hmm. And so these are really exciting insights, I think, about how we age and the control that we have. She also reports that in her research, people with the APOE4 genes, this means that they have extra risk of developing dementia. I'll kind of break this down and go on a tangent for a minute, just so everybody understands what I'm talking about. So the ApoE genes are associated with fat metabolism, and there's essentially three options, and you get two of them, one from mom, one from dad. You can have a 2, 3, or 4. And if you have twos, you actually get some benefit. You get some reduction in risk. And if you have threes, you also have less risk. But if you have fours, if mom or dad has given you a 4, or if you have a 4-4, a mom and dad have given you a 4, you have a highly increased risk of developing dementia. This risk can go up to 50%, 1 in 2 chance of developing dementia in your lifetime if you have a 4-4. And then if you have a 3-4, you have a 1 in 3 chance of developing dementia, where the normal population has a 13% chance of developing dementia. And if you have a 2 in there, you have about a 9% chance of developing dementia. So what we are essentially looking at is that increase in risk from 13 to 50% with that ApoE4-4 status. Now, Becca Levy in her book describes how that risk is completely eliminated if you have a positive association with aging. So if you're channeling, I always think of channeling Betty White. If we can just channel that, imagine that we're going to live that life of humor and engagement and productivity and in community into our 90s and beyond, then we can live longer, healthier, happier lives with better cognitive function.
Yeah. Yeah. And this ties into the growing information we have on epigenetics. So we're talking about how our mindset has an impact on that, which then affects aging. I just published an article on how I thought that purpose is the ultimate in use it or lose it. And so purpose feeds into that epigenetic model where we have the ability to influence our aging process.
Yeah, it's really phenomenal how much control we have over the aging process. So her book is called Breaking the Age Code. I'm so sorry, I was blanking on that, but very, very much in alignment with what we're discussing here. I think another misconception around Alzheimer's that's really important to point out is that beta amyloid plaques have been sort of the smoking gun, the issue that we point to as the cause of Alzheimer's. And in fact, what we know about Alzheimer's is that that's not the full story. Although there's clearly a correlation between amyloid plaques, tau proteins, and a incidence of dementia, those are not necessarily the causal factors. And when we think about causal factors, these things are much more within our control, right? Beta amyloid plaque, like, what is that? What does that even mean? How do I control that? It feels very much outside of us. And we're sitting here waiting for science to save us, to give us that magic pill or that magic IV. When in fact, I think that's been a little bit misguided because this is a multifactorial disease, a very complex disease that requires a more complex solution to meet it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. And I totally agree with that. And can you share your perspective on the role of inflammation in this process?
Absolutely. So again, you know, inflammation, I think, is a much better kind of explanation of Alzheimer's than certainly beta amyloid plaques are. However, even inflammation begs the question, why? What is causing inflammation? And so that's where I go back to this very systematic, but more comprehensive approach that's described by Dr. Dale Bredesen, who I'm sure is on your summit, I hope. Essentially, what we're doing is we're describing what are all of the things we're not only describing, but assessing what are all of the things that might impact neuronal or brain cell function? And how do we optimize for that? So what are the toxins doing? What, you know, are there too many? Are there too little, right? Are we getting them in and out? Are they flushing through the system? So toxins, infections, is there an infectious burden that is causing inflammation? Are there enough nutrients to get those toxins and infections and other things that might trigger inflammation out of the system and keep our systems, even the basic metabolic waste that every cell creates, can we get that out of the system so it doesn't get caught up in there and create inflammation? And then is there structurally, is there blood flow in and out of the brain, right? Can you get oxygen to your brain at night? Do you have sleep apnea? Have you been hit over the head with a baseball bat at some point in your life? I mean, this literally comes up in my office and my practice. And so certainly traumatic brain injuries will contribute to inflammation in the brain. And then also, we talked about stress a little bit already, but stressors can also, having too much cortisol, although it's anti-inflammatory, over time can create imbalances, certainly in those stress hormones in the brain, and reduce the size of the hippocampus directly. So there's a big connection between stress. We've all kind of been in that situation of either not getting enough sleep or feeling under pressure and not being able to make our brains work, right? Or we can't spit out what we're trying to say. And many of us can relate to that experience of feeling under stress and not feeling like we can remember well. And so those are that plus signaling hormones. So things like peptides, stress hormones, sex hormones, vitamin D, thyroid hormones, all of these signals are really important. And then of course, diet, I kind of put in that category of both signaling and nutrients, is that we need to eat the right things, be on a relatively anti-inflammatory diet, or at least not a pro-inflammatory diet, so that our cells can be made. They can use those building blocks to literally create the structure of our cells in an anti-inflammatory way. There's so many pieces of this. Exercise, of course, helps with reducing inflammation and being enough stress, right? If we're couch potatoes and we're just laying around, there's not enough stress on the body for there to be engagement that's going to keep us moving and going and blood flowing. Same thing with brain engagement. We need enough of it, but not too much. It can't be so much that we give up, but we want enough brain engagement that we work that muscle.
Well, this is probably a good point in our conversation to take a look at your program. And your program maximizes for supporting cognitive function and as well in slowing the aging process. So maybe you can share with us your approach and your program and the components of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I feel so fortunate to work with Dr. Bredesen and be supported by him as a mentor and to be so clued into his work. And so I have really done my best. I'm shamelessly riding his coattails here to plug the gaps of his work by making this more accessible and more practical, I guess, for people, because it is hard. And when we talk about changing diet, changing the environment, exercising more, this can be a full-time job, scheduling a sleep study. All of these pieces require a lot of cognitive work. And for many people with full cognitive capacity, making these changes in their busy lives is challenging. And so what we've aimed to do is essentially reduce the friction. And I've done that in a couple of ways. And one is through Marama, which is a residential care facility for the elderly located here in San Diego County. Although we are quickly expanding, we're partnering with a group in Wichita, Kansas. We just announced that this week. And so really excited to be able to help more people. We've had a waiting list for well over a year, and this is an immersive experience. So I get how challenging it is. I live this lifestyle myself, and it can often feel like a burden. However, it feels so good to be in ketosis, to be eating good food, to be exercising regularly, and getting good sleep, having your brain engaged, being in community. All of those things are so valuable, and I love watching people. It's just an absolute privilege and so much fun watching people get the benefits of it. And I get how challenging it can be to do on your own at home. So we take care of it for you when you or your loved one moves into Marama or our partner facilities. And that is just, I mean, doing that and seeing those beautiful souls just thriving is the privilege of my life. It's so fun. We also offer the Marama at Home course because not everybody can make it to San Diego, right? There are all kinds of constraints. And my goal really is to make senior living facilities like that obsolete, because I would love for people to stay in at home in the fabric of their community where the people they love are right there, be able to work, continue to work. And also, most importantly, as I mentioned, my confidence is higher when people intervene in this disease process earlier on. And so instead of waiting to need to go to a place like Marama, do all of these things at home. So we help support people through that with the Marama at Home course. It's just maramaathome.com. It's a 12-module course where I break it down and take you through everything that we're doing at Marama day to day. We give you the daily schedules, tell you about the equipment we have, and then you can create as much of that at home as possible and get all of the benefits there. We offer additional coaching, and I will even go to people's homes here and there when I have time and when that allows. And that's really, really, really fun for me. I absolutely love it.
Well, Heather, let's go more deeply into some of the actual steps mm-hmm. of the program.
Sure.
So that people who are watching this can take advantage of this information.
Absolutely. So we're actually going to give you a free diet guide, the ketogenic diet guide, and that'll be available here at the summit. And this is probably 50% of what we do. I think people get so much benefit from getting into ketosis. There's tons and tons of questions that come up around diet. Now, I'm not suggesting that you get into ketosis forever, but for somebody struggling with cognitive decline today, I would recommend being in ketosis for 3 to 6 months. Now, work with your provider to make sure that this is absolutely safe for you. There are certain conditions like kidney issues, potentially if you've had gallstones or gallbladder issues, this can be a little bit more challenging and you might want to work with a health coach. Right. If your cholesterol is high, don't worry too much. We can usually actually get good results over time and lower your cholesterol through a ketogenic diet that includes lots of fiber, lots of veggies. So what we're looking for here is to basically flip the switch of your metabolism from burning sugar for fuel to burning fat for fuel. And your brain loves this. So your brain preferentially will burn fat instead of sugar for fuel. And as we age, one of the things that seems to happen pretty consistently is that we lose insulin resistance and we lose efficiency when it comes to turning sugar or glucose into ATP or the fuel our cells run on. And so when we just change out the fuel, we get more efficiency in creating that fuel and in creating the energy that our brain needs to run. And through that, there can be more repair, more regeneration, clearer thought patterns, less fatigue. It's really amazing to watch. I'll tell you that some of my patients, they come in and they kind of look like wilted flowers and they get into ketosis and they just sort of start to blossom. They're standing up straighter. You can see that there's more energy. They're much more engaged in conversation. It's really, really fun to watch. And so what we do there is it's carbohydrate restriction. Many people will need to get to around 30 grams of carbs, restricted to 30 grams of carbohydrates a day. And it's lots of emphasis on veggies, leafy green veggies, the non-starchy veggies, all of your cruciferous, your Brussels sprouts, your cauliflower, broccoli, your chard, kale, arugula. I mean, the list goes on and on. I'm often in ketosis and it feels great. And I don't feel restricted. Heavy in fats, lots of coconut oil, olive oil, and I don't have people restrict dairy unless, of course, they are sensitive to it. Then, of course, if you're lactose intolerant or otherwise sensitive to dairy, absolutely restrict that. And then plenty of animal protein, some nuts and seeds and all of the spices. Basically, anything that won't raise blood sugar is on the yes list. And there is a lot of yummy, yummy stuff you can put on there. And so, then flipping that.
Excuse me, yeah. just to be clear, a ketotic diet is about shifting the body from burning sugar to burning fat. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. And so sugar, I'll interchangeably use carbohydrate, sugar, glucose. Those can be anything from like Skittles or a Snickers bar to breads, pastas, even things like fruit that are often considered very healthy. And I think fruit is very seasonal fruit, very healthy, starchy veggies, very healthy, like beets and carrots and butternut squash, say. Very healthy things. But if we want to achieve the goal of ketosis, then what we want to do is restrict those carbohydrates or sugars completely.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And so you're saying, I think I heard you say, this is probably the most important piece of the program.
It's certainly one of them, and it's also the most accessible because you can do all of this from home. You don't need fancy testing. You don't need anything. It's just a commitment to eating differently.
Mm-hmm. So I know you have you've had different coaching programs and ongoing programs. Have people been able to adapt to this and adopt this, or do people struggle with it? What's your experience, and how do you? The ones that are struggling, how do you help those?
Yes, yeah, such a great question. Again, it's just been a privilege watching people and learning together as they go through this process. Then there's a mixed bag. So some people, and I can't even always predict it, there are some people that just grab the bull by the horns and go for it. And they are fully in, totally committed, and they just do whatever it takes to get into ketosis, to optimize their diet, their sleep, their exercise. And it's really impressive. What I see is that there are other people who kind of prove that the concept works because they go in and out of it. And we had a gentleman recently who, you know, when he's in ketosis, he remembers his grandchildren's names. And when he's not, he doesn't. And you can kind of see this switch go on and off. And it really, I think, is a resource utilization issue for him, particularly when he's getting those that fuel to his brain. He can remember really important things. And when he's not, he stops remembering. And so many people will report this. Of course, the holidays come up and they kind of fall off the wagon, or they're traveling, they fall off the wagon, but they get those benefits back often if they can get right back to it.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're proposing and suggesting for people that have mild cognitive decline, that's true for everybody in terms of, even if you don't have mild cognitive decline, it can prevent or postpone that, I'm assuming, correct?
Certainly, that's what, you know, it's much easier to prove reversal than prevention, right? Just in terms of time scale. But certainly, that's what I would propose, is that, yeah, we can prevent and at least delay the onset of cognitive decline when people are adopting this diet and this lifestyle. And also, I think doing the medical component is important, but it's kind of the icing on the cake. The 80-20 is definitely in the lifestyle component, in my opinion, and from what I've seen. So, and again, as I mentioned, when we have people with MOCAs in the 20s, we get complete reversal. We see them go back to 30, go back to getting perfect scores. And so my confidence is much higher when we can intervene then. And that you could almost consider prevention, because their diagnosis would be mild cognitive impairment and they're not progressing to Alzheimer's the way you would expect.
Right, right. Can you go into a little bit more detail of the other components, like, what do you think is important in terms of amount of exercise, amount of sleep, and any other parts of your program?
Yeah, absolutely. So exercise is another one I love to talk about, because there's a couple misconceptions here. So I'm really proud of anyone who walks. Walking is amazing. I love it. And if our goal is to reverse or prevent dementia or Alzheimer's disease, we have to do more than walking. Walking is not going to be enough. So what I recommend is kind of thinking of exercise in four categories: your aerobic, your strength training, your dual task exercise, and I'll talk more about each of these, and then your contrast oxygen therapy. And so at a very minimum, you want to be doing aerobic exercise and strength training exercise. And that aerobic exercise, the definition here is going to come from the Framingham trial. And this is 200 minutes a week at your target heart rate. So this is give or take four 1 hour classes, or 1 hour bike rides, 1 hour jog run kind of things. You want to get your heart rate up to moderate rate. And the way you calculate this is 220 minus your age. And you take that number, your max heart rate, and multiply it by 0.75 or 75% and 0.85, 85% of that max heart rate. And you get your target heart rate between 75 and 85% of that max heart rate. You want to be there for 200 minutes a week. So if your walk does that, then fantastic. You're doing good work. If not, then we've got to up the ante and get your heart pumping a little bit more to get that extra blood flow to your brain. So that's aerobic exercise. Hopefully many of you listening can check that box and you're getting that. Strength training is the next one. We want to be growing muscle because muscle sends a lot of those great signals to the brain, like testosterone and BDNF, to the brain to support neurotrophic effects. So both growth and the connections, neuroplastic effects between the different neurons. So we want to be getting those signals through strength training exercise. And this can be lifting weights, or it could be yoga or Pilates, or anything that helps engage your muscles. Climbing, there are lots of functional, fun exercises that different people can do. And sometimes for some people, it's chair yoga. And for other people, it's PT or OT exercises. There's a whole spectrum. We just want to meet you at your edge there. And then dual task exercises. This is a little bit newer in the research, and many people have not heard of this, but there's massive amounts of benefit of combining cognitive exercise with strength or aerobic exercise. So for someone, this might be as simple as going to a class like yoga, Pilates, Zumba, something where you're being cued by the instructor. If that engages your brain significantly, if you're not checked out, like if I go to Pilates and she's like, bring your right arm down to your left hip, like I can kind of be checked out thinking about work or other things. That's not engaging for me. But for somebody else, sometimes it's really hard to put together those pieces of the cues while you're exercising. That's great. That works. For other people, what they'll do is they'll go for a run and they'll be listening to a podcast. They'll pause the podcast and repeat back what they just learned. For someone else, they might, have a granddaughter quiz them on the names of all their great-grandchildren, or on the birthdays of all their great-grandchildren, or on the presidents from start to finish, or the 50 states and the capitals, right? You can get creative math problems about how you engage your brain while you're exercising. Now, neither of these are marathon.
What added mechanism does that engage in terms of benefit? Gosh.
You'll have to interview Sarah McEwen because she's the one who did the research at the Pacific Brain Science Centers. And she is wonderful and delightful and could answer all of the mechanistic questions there. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I know that it works and that there's data out there that proves this. Okay. And there's good data from the TBI clinics and also from Parkinson's research, this dual task. So the if anybody's looking for some of these, if you Google or go to YouTube and search for dual task exercises, you will see a bunch of examples come up.
Great, great.
And get some good ideas.
And then the fourth area you were...
Yeah, the fourth area is contrast oxygen therapy. And so we use a device called the LIVO2. And essentially what we're doing is recreating exercising at altitude and then exercising at depth, really, because you're going back and forth. Air that we breathe day to day is about 20% oxygen. And through the LIVO2 system, you concentrate oxygen and get it up to about 80% oxygen. What you're breathing while you're exercising. And then you go to negative and you go back and forth between positive and negative. And that negative oxygen is about 8%. So you go from 80% to 8% when what we typically breathe is 20%. And in going back and forth, what you get is vasodilation. So all of your blood vessels get really, really big when they're feeling starved of oxygen. This is as the carbon dioxide goes up. And then you flip the switch and you get this concentrated oxygen that goes into the lungs and then is very quickly able to glom on to those red blood cells and deliver oxygen to the tissues through those great big expanded blood vessels. So you get pressure changes, you get a little bit of stress on the system. I'm sure you have lots of speakers discussing the hormetic effect. So you put a little stress on the system and what you expect is a more resilient, healthier system. And part of that is by getting rid of senescent cells and also signaling the system to produce more mitochondria, which is where that fuel or ATP is created in the cells. Mm-hmm. And so as we stress the system a little bit by going back and forth between positive and negative O2, we get some of those amazing benefits.
Nice. And lastly, what's your recommendation with regard to sleep? Because there's a lot of research out there showing that sleep deficits is a great liability.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that we test immediately on almost everyone is for sleep apnea. So certainly I recommend everyone prioritize sleep and get the amount of sleep that allows you to wake up feeling rested in the morning. And so if that means 9 hours for one person or 10 hours for one person, maybe even temporarily, certainly for teenagers, then enjoy that, get that rest. If for you, you've not just gotten by on 7 hours, but if you can wake up without an alarm feeling rested after 7 hours, that might be enough for you. I have had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Michael Bruce. I don't know if you're having him on, but he's the sleep doc, and he talks about the importance of consistency. Going to bed within about a 15-minute window, the same time every night. And when you're not basically creating jet lag by going to bed at 9 p.m. one night and 2 a.m. the next night, when you're not shifting your bedtime too dramatically, you start to get much more efficient sleep. And so getting the right amount of sleep is certainly important, prioritizing sleep, thinking of it as an investment in your health, and also being absolutely sure that you don't have sleep apnea. And if you have any amount of sleep apnea, even if you've had a sleep doc tell you that it's mild, I recommend treating any apneic events relatively aggressively through either mouth tape, you know, if you snore, maybe nasal breathe right strips. I actually do just use the Somnifix and the breathe right strips because the adhesive on the generics is not great. And so they don't tend to work as well. And then there are mouth guards that you can use from specialty dentists. And then of course the CPAPs or the APAPs, the alternating pressure devices that you can use for sleep. And if you have apnea, please use that. If you have one that's been sitting in the corner and you can't get it to fit right, or you haven't been using it regularly, please, please, please get that fit, get a different one, do what you need to do to aggressively treat that sleep apnea. Because if you have apnea, if you're having those events at night, it's essentially like having mild brain damage every night. And as a brain doctor, I'm not okay with that ever.
Well, that's very good and useful information. Do you have data on results that you've gotten, or can you share any data that's out there on reversal of Alzheimer's, slowing it down?
Yeah, there is really exciting data. So Dr. Bredesen and his team, Kat Toops, is the primary author on that, the first author on the paper that was published in July of 2022 in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. And what they showed was that 84% of participants who did this Bredesen approach had a reversal, measurable reversal in their cognitive decline, in their dementia. And I would say that we took a group, a cohort in my office, and we're looking forward to submitting that paper very soon. We took 23 participants through 6 months of intervention. The Bredesen paper, they did 9 months of intervention. We took participants with MoCAs between 12 and 23. So this is definitely measurable cognitive decline, significant measurable cognitive decline. And we had results that were relatively similar. So, and what you would expect, it wasn't quite at 84%, but we're really excited to publish that work. And I'm really excited to be able to say publicly exactly what my expectations are when someone with a MoCA score between 12 and 23 comes in 6 months and the results that we get.
Yeah, that's great when you can share these results, because it's really encouraging to someone who's has this kind of situation. And I'm wondering, given this evidence, given this approach and how it seems to be so helpful, why and also given how everybody is so fearful of Alzheimer's, why isn't this information more shown on the news programs and people being made aware of it?
Oh, you know, this is, I like could pull my hair out. there's actually, I have it right here. There's a book called How Not to Study a Disease, The Story of Alzheimer's. It's written by a gentleman named Carl Haroop, and it essentially answers exactly this question. We have been down a rabbit hole chasing this hypothesis that beta amyloid plaques are responsible for Alzheimer's. And it's a dead end. It's not getting us where we need to be. There was just this week, there was another monoclonal antibody that came out, and it's like promising results. You know, this is all over the news. What it does at its best, is it slows the progression of a torturous disease. Essentially, they're saying, here, pay tens of thousands of dollars a year, Medicare, for this, taxpayers, for this very expensive drug that makes the torture for people, not just the person suffering with the disease, but also their caregivers and their loved ones and their families that are on this long path to goodbye. It says, enjoy this longer. Mm. Awesome. Mm. Like, what value does that bring to society? I get so upset about this. I'm sorry. And then I just get back to work because I can't focus on this part too much. So many dollars, literally $1.6 billion last year alone, in 2021 alone, went to studying the beta amyloid plaque hypothesis. And much of that, some of that, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but much of that was based on a 2006 paper that was published by Nature that said that these amyloid plaques were the smoking gun connecting them to cognition. Amyloid plaques have been used as a surrogate marker. What do we really care about? We care about someone's ability to use the bathroom on their own, to go grocery shopping, to drive, to maintain an independent life, to have a conversation with their friends, to remember their children's names. That's what we care about. We don't really care how much beta amyloid plaque there is, mm-hmm. unless it's connected to cognitive function. Right. And there was a paper in 2006 that was published, a mouse trial out of the University of Minnesota, that connected cognitive decline with amyloid plaques. Well, we found out this summer that it was completely fraudulent. Mm. It is maddening to think about, you know, and there's good and bad actors in every field, but to think that so many taxpayer dollars have been dedicated to this hypothesis when it's based on fraudulent data, you have to hope that there is something good that will come out of this amyloid plaque rabbit hole that we've spent so much time and smart people's money and energy on. But I don't know, like the 99.6% of the research trials that are done on that, they fail. Wow. What are we doing? Yeah. What are we doing? Yeah. I just don't understand. And Carl Harup in this book explains how over and over again, first with Alois Alzheimer in 1906, there, it was basically a marketing ploy. That was one case study. It was one individual. And Alzheimer's, his mentor, published a textbook, and he had a new textbook, Psychiatry is what it was called. And that was published in 1907, I believe, or 1908. And he needed new information to put in the textbook. So he took that case study and put it in the textbook. You guys both know the medical world. You don't put case studies in textbooks. You put the data in textbooks after it's been validated and it's gone through scientific rigor. So that was kind of the first elevation. And then several times since then, for very political reasons, for marketing, really not for scientific reasons, Alzheimer's has been elevated in a way that does not serve the public and people who are suffering with this disease through multiple channels. And I could talk about this for way too long.
Well, first off, I'm glad that you are supporting a procedure, a way of doing this that actually shows benefit and shows great promise. And so I really appreciate you coming on our program today, our summit, to give us and the audience all of this very valuable information. Share with the audience how they can reach you and where they could find your programs and take advantage of it.
Yeah, so Marama, M-A-R-A-M-A, MaramaAtHome.com is where you can find the coaching program and the course on how to develop Marama at your home. Or if you're interested or you have a loved one who you think would benefit from living at a Marama residence, it's Marama, M-A-R-A-M-A, MaramaExperience.com. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and we'd be delighted to be of service.
Yeah. And you also earlier mentioned something that people can get as a free bonus here. Can you mention that again?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, I think diet is probably 50%. It's 50% of the heavy lifting of this approach. And the ketogenic diet, a highly, you know, plant-involved ketogenic diet, is what I think works best. And so we're going to give away a free keto diet guide, and you'll have access to that through the summit. And I wish you well, and please send us any questions you have about that. We have coaching available if you want to just dive into the diet piece as well.
Great. That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Heather. I appreciate all of the valuable information you've given to our audience, and look forward to hearing more progress in your approach.
It's always a pleasure to connect with you. Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.
Bye-bye.
If you are enjoying this program, please hit that subscribe button, or even better, leave a review. Your support makes it possible for us to create the quality programming that we're continually striving for.
Can I start? Is it recording?
It's already recording.
Oh, sorry. This is for general information and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to constitute or substitute for medical advice or counseling. The practice of medicine or the provision of healthcare, or diagnosis or treatment, or the creation of a physician-patient or clinical relationship. The use of this information is at their own user's risk. If you find this to be on the value, please hit that like button to subscribe to support the work that we do on this channel. And we take your suggestions and advice very seriously, so please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we hope to see you next time. You should say that.
You like it? You want to do it one more time?
Is that good?
I think that was good.
Yes.
You need to save the recording.